Welcome to another episode of New Books and Poetry. I'm your host, John Ebersole, and I am delighted to be joined by Mark Wunderlich, whose latest book is The Earth of Veils, out by Grey Wolf. Mark, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
All right, excellent. So I was recently in an interview. Somebody asked me what I thought was, like, hands down, like, a great book I was reading, and yours definitely was the first to come to mind. It's really just one of the best books I've just read in a long time. It really just spoke to me. But before we get into it, I definitely wanted to back up. And, well, I feel like I've learned a lot about you, whether through your books or prior interviews. I really don't know anything about, like exactly where your childhood took place. I know it was in Wisconsin. But can you talk about your childhood, where you grew up, where you were raised, and also about your family?
Sure. I grew up in a very small town in southwestern Wisconsin called Fountain City, and it's not the closest sizable town is Winona, Minnesota, so it's right on the banks of the Mississippi River, and the town is about 700, a population of about 700 people, and I think at its sort of highest, it was maybe about 1,200, and back at 700 now. So it's a very small town and has consistently been small. It's a primarily a farming community, and my family has lived in this area, in this part of Wisconsin, I think since the 1830s. Mm-hmm. So, there were Wunderlichs who founded the town and were some of the first settlers to come and build there. And so my family's been in the area for a really long time, since, my father's family, since they immigrated from Germany. And but my immediate family's very small. Mm-hmm. I have one brother and my mom and my dad. I grew up on a farm there, though my father was really only a part-time farmer.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a kind of, my grandparents lived nearby and some other relatives, but my family remained small and is getting even smaller.
Yes, indeed. And, is your brother, is he younger or older than you?
He's 3 years older and he lives in Portland, Oregon.
Oh, does he? And do you, see him often or?
Not that often, actually.
Yeah.
Now it's really just holidays, typically. So it seems, more and more rare that the whole family gets together.
that's definitely true. So I'm curious. I'm going to really fast forward and jump right into kind of, what we share in common is time at Columbia and coming from that. Such a rural background, is that what drew you particularly to New York City to do graduate work there, or did you already kind of have experience in urban centers before reaching New York City?
I really didn't. I think I graduated from college. I went to the University of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And I graduated from college. Madison seemed like a big cosmopolitan place to me. And in many ways, it's a really big college town.
Yeah.
It is sophisticated, but my own experience of urban places, I hadn't, until I moved there, I had visited New York City once. I had been to Chicago a handful of times. I, knew Minneapolis. I'd been to Berlin when I was in high school German club. But it really, I had no experience of living in a city.
Right.
And when I was, 21, I had managed to save $700. And I bought a one-way plane ticket to New York City, and I thought, what could possibly go wrong? I have $700.
You're loaded.
I'll be fine. And in fact, I was. So I moved there in, I think it was January of 1992.
Wow.
And I worked in New York for a while before I started Columbia, before I went to graduate school there.
Yeah. And what, you know, what was that kind of pivotal moment where you're like, okay, poetry's for me? Did it like occur to you as like a young child, or like what kind of, was there a culture of reading in your house growing up and you naturally gravitated towards books? What kind of, how did you kind of, you know, become a reader and then eventually find yourself drawn to poetry?
Well, I've always read, you know, as far back as I can remember, as soon as I was taught, you know, when I was 4 or 5. But my mother read to me as a child all the time. I remember my grandmother reading to me. My mother is a big reader. My father, not so much, but, so there were books in the house, and I had, you know, I had books in my room as a child, and I was always in them. You know, I spent a lot of time there. So reading was definitely a part of my experience growing up. You know, the bookmobile would come to town, and that was on the calendar all the time. It really it really meant a lot to me. You know, it's a thing that has changed now that is kind of hard. Sometimes, you know, for my students, it's hard for them to wrap their minds around. It's just thinking about how isolated rural America really was before the internet, you know. Right. I mean, I just didn't have access to a lot of things, to information, to books, to other sort of viewpoints and opinions. It was much harder to get to that. I did not write. I was not one of those kids who was a sort of precocious writer of charming poems, you know.
Right.
I that never.
Your parents weren't asking you to read poetry like at dinners or whatever.
No, that was not it. And in fact, that kind of, you know, that would have been seen as showing off,
right,
as sort of as a kind of vanity or something. You know, my family was religious. I grew up going to church weekly, often more than once a week.
Yeah, what kind of church?
And I was raised in basically a kind of bloodless Protestantism.
Yes.
With Calvinist roots.
Yes.
You know, it was the United Church of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, it had been a Swiss Reformed Church before they joined the UCC. So it was basically harmless.
Yeah.
You know, I can't say that there were, you know, I read the Bible and, you know, knew the Bible stories, and that's an enduring about it that I'm glad I had as part of my experience growing up.
Yeah, but, I think that, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I didn't write as a child as I can remember at all. In fact, I didn't even know, I don't know when it dawned on me that there was such a thing as a living poet.
Right.
I just don't think that, you know, I really thought that was like being a, you know, I think I said somewhere else that it was like, I thought it was like being a stagecoach driver or something.
Right.
You know, it was so antiquated and out of place. And then when it did, it wasn't really until college that kind of entered my consciousness.
Yeah, that's interesting. And at Madison, it's interesting that you kind of were immersed in language. And it's funny, someone who goes to church growing up, while you might be like not fully grasping everything, it is based on language and the word. So you're constantly awash in a heightened language or a different rhetoric, a different sounding rhetoric. And it sounds like the church you went to was probably had a deep respect for kind of the literary roots of the Bible and stuff, and not so immersed on the idea of, maybe being saved or personal salvation kind of thing. Because I know, those churches are often, it's hard to distinguish between a sermon and a lecture sometimes. Which can be extremely refreshing for somebody who's maybe grown up in a different tradition. But when you're at Madison, I mean, when was it somebody you met, or like when, I'm really trying to pinpoint, like, when did you decide then to go get an MFA in poetry?
Well, let's see. I had been, I was a German major, and I had spent actually my freshman year in a language immersion program. Mm. I was part of Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota. And that school was sort of too small for me. I wanted to be at a bigger place, and I wanted desperately to be anonymous, having never had that experience in my life. So then when I transferred to the UW, I continued on studying German, and you know, this was I loved the study of foreign languages, and you know, that was something I was good at it, and I liked doing that. But I needed to take an English class as a requirement, and I ended up registering for like a mixed genre writing workshop.
Oh wow!
By accident, and I that first day in class. It was just astonishing to me. You know, we read poems on the very first day. I don't think I had ever read a poem by a living poet. I just know it wasn't part of my experience. And it was as though suddenly a language was being spoken that I understood completely. I was so excited by it.
Yeah.
There was something about the compression and the strangeness of it that really drew me in, and kind of from that moment on, I never looked back. You know, I just thought, how do you do this? How do you go about doing this? I remember reading some of the first poets I read. I remember spending a lot of time on the biographical notes at the back of the book.
Yeah.
And looking at the pictures and, you know, at the author photos and reading their bios and thinking, how did they do that? You know, how did they get to this place where this is what they do?
Right.
You know,
that is so interesting. I think that's not common, but an experience for many of us where the poet, once you unlock that you like this poetry, you're like, how do you go about fashioning a life around it? You know?
Yeah.
It's really incredible. And what were your parents thinking at the time? Were they, were they always supportive of this kind of path you were taking?
I think that my parents probably had the same sort of concerns about this particular path that they had, that anyone's parents would have, in that they were worried about how I would make a living. You know, that's one of their great concerns, and not unexpectedly. But they should have been just as concerned of how I would make a living studying German. You know, I mean, as it turns out, but that, for some reason, that seemed more, that made more sense to them.
Yeah.
But I've always had a job. I was always working. I was always, you know, doing things. I don't think my parents worried all that much about my ability to make my own way.
Yeah.
And that I would figure it out. I think that they are surprised now, that, you know, that this is kind of what I do for a living, that I teach poems and talk about poems and write poems. And
so. Yeah, it could be somewhat bewildering as well. And, so of course, and not to, just to get a little more personal, you know, being very open as a gay man, how did this conjoin, you think, where, like, when you're at Madison, were you already, like, completely out? Or, because your first book is obviously, like, really, you know, really, like, diving into these subjects, I'm wondering where you are in your personal life. Were you openly gay in your hometown, in that rural setting? I think I'm really curious about that.
No, I was not, not as a teenager.
Right.
Although, I was certainly identified that way by other people, you know,
sure.
I mean, I was, you know, you would say certainly, I mean, I'm very resistant to this kind of narrative of, you know, you're sort of bullied as a gay person growing up. You get bullied and
right.
then you escape to a city. And, you know, I mean, it's
I know. I hear you. I totally agree.
But I certainly was bullied. You know, I have to say, I really was. My high school experience was rough.
It was.
And I went to kindergarten through 12th grade with the same 60 some students, you know, the same people for 13 years.
Oh,
we were together, in this rural consolidated school.
Yeah.
And, you know, and, I rebelled, I think, in my own way when I was in high school.
Yeah.
I was a bit of a goth.
Mm-hmm.
It was the 80s.
Yeah.
And in that way, I ended up standing out and targeting myself even more. Now, I'm not saying I was to blame for it, but I didn't make things any easier for myself.
I hear you.
That said, you know, I don't think, I didn't really kind of fully come out until I was in college.
Yeah.
My freshman year, you know, you sort of step in and out a little bit by the time I was a sophomore. I had busted out. And, while I was at Madison, I moved into an apartment and my next door neighbor was Dan Savage.
Hmm.
And Dan and I became friends. And he was, started the Madison chapter of ACT UP. And
I was like, if you're going to meet anybody that's going to make that transition smooth, it's probably him.
It was really, it's true, you know, so he was really very much a part of that, you know, kind of seeing, you know, Dan's a little older than I am, but
yeah.
just seeing how he was and kind of throwing myself into different kinds of activism, things
right.
like that. So by that point, I was out and not going back.
Yeah, and was the reaction from your parents kind of like, oh, yeah, we already knew that, or like, you know, was it pretty supportive, or did it cause any, like, you know, I don't know, I mean.
Well, you know, I don't know how
parents internalize these things, you know.
Yeah, it was actually a little rough.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, I think it was particularly difficult for my mother.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that for a while there was a period of time where they didn't really, I wouldn't say that I was sort of completely rejected by them, but
right.
they were pretty
yeah.
cold.
Kind
know?
Of freaked
and
out.
They were freaked out and they distanced themselves.
Yeah. You know, and I'm wondering sometimes because in instances like that, a lot of times when I think parents, something happens with their child that disrupts whatever their conception of the child was, that they often the experience is happening suddenly to them and they alienate the child who is actually at the center of the trauma almost, you know, like,
yeah.
and some parents, I don't know, I think they react, this is happening to me instead of maybe
yeah.
thinking it was happening to you, you know?
Yeah.
So that is very, I can totally sympathize. That was very hard, to go through when the people we, our parents who we look to these, you know, these grand figures in our life suddenly we confuse them or something. Yeah.
I think that's really, you know, that's really true. I will say, you know, if I were going to look for a sort of upshot of that experience
mm-hmm.
is that in a lot of ways, it really, it set me free.
Right.
And I mean that in that, I realized that I did have to make my own way and that I was going to, there might be something about me, something very essential about my character, about my personality, my psyche, my makeup that my parents might reject and that the people who, you know, were around me, and were, you know, who I expected would love me unconditionally. It turns out that there might be some conditions,
yeah.
and that is a hard lesson, but it was one that made me, you know, it made me grow up.
Yeah.
It made me it made me be a lot more independent.
Yes.
And to, it gave me permission to make decisions for myself in ways that sometimes, you know, one of the things that, that you get, or, you know, now I suppose there are parents who are very understanding about their gay children and
sure.
it's just the same as anyone. But I uh-huh. think the experience that I had and that other, you know, gay and lesbian people of my generation who I know who've had similar experiences, they talk about how, you know, once you sort of horrify your parents, there's nothing else, you know, there's kind of nothing else.
I know.
To do,
so
you know,
true.
You can, you have permission to kind of do whatever it is you're going to do and to live your life. And I have friends who are, you know, heterosexual friends who are more conventional, who are sometimes in relationships where they feel very beholden to pleasing their parents
right.
well into their adulthood, that they need to have the
I think that's
kind of marriage and
that's absolutely
you know,
true. Yeah, and I think I bet some people even, you know, even fantasize about the passing of their parents even to set them free, not in a cold, you know, psychotic way, but in a way, like if those intrusive thoughts of feeling like I'm not going to be able to be myself until maybe they're like gone. You know? So I think
yeah.
you're right to have that kind of traumatic, maybe that break early in one's life. And at the same time, what we want from our parents is just, we just merely want to be loved as who we truly are, no matter who you are. And I think you're right. In many ways, one's sexuality and one's relationship with the family pushes that envelope maybe quicker than
yeah.
maybe some other people. So, yeah it's really fascinating.
You know, that,
oh, go ahead.
That said, I will just follow it up and say that, you know, my relationship with my family now is very, you know, with my parents is really very good.
Right.
And it is, you know, people change. They really do, and yeah, and our relationships with each other change. Everybody's getting older. I have a much happier, a really kind of happy, lovely relationship with my parents now.
Yeah.
So I just want to say that it has a happy ending.
Oh, of course. Yeah, I know. No, I think that's really a key what you said. That I think sometimes the parents seem like unchanging monoliths, and in fact, even parents, and I think a misperception of even older people is that they have these very static interior lives and that they're not up for change. And in fact, their interior lives are just as in flux and dynamic as they were when they were young. So,
yeah.
I mean, maybe
yeah.
some things have cemented beyond movement, but I don't know. So moving back, so you're in Madison and you're kind of sounding like you're coming into your own identity at the same time you're kind of discovering poetry. And then, so you decide to move to New York at around
yes.
that. So you had a couple of years in Madison with poetry and kind of like really cementing who you were as a person. And then you get to New York. How did that impact you? I know we've already talked about it a little. So you were like 21. You decide.
Yes.
To go to Columbia, and did you apply anywhere else, or was that pretty much you knew you wanted to go there?
I did. I applied to three places when I was looking to go to a graduate program. I applied to Columbia, which was where I wanted to go above all other places.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was always at the top of my list.
Yeah.
Then I applied to NYU,
yeah.
which I was also interested in, and then as kind of a wild card, I applied to the University of Oregon.
Wow.
And when the letters came in, I was waitlisted at NYU.
Yeah.
I got into Columbia, but I got into the U of O and I received a full tuition, a full
oh
package.
Oh my God.
Financial aid package.
That must have been so. Yeah. So go ahead.
Well, so I ended up, I really, really, as I said, I really wanted to stay in New York and go to Columbia, and I made a bad decision.
Yeah.
I accepted the University of Oregon.
Really?
And, yep.
Wow.
And I got all the way, I left New York City, I rented an apartment in Eugene.
Oh my God.
I drove with my things to my parents' house, And then I was going to have, some other things were going on, a truck that was going out there.
Yeah.
And I was in my parents' driveway in my car, ready to go. And I just turned off the car engine and I didn't go.
Yeah.
I thought, I can't do this. I'm making the wrong decision.
Right.
I don't want to go to Oregon. So I called out there and told them I wasn't coming, and I invoked the fury of Garrett Hongo, who was directing the program.
Oh my God.
I hope he's gotten over it now. I think he should probably not be too angry at a 21-year-old who made an impulsive decision.
True.
But I turned around and I went back to New York City.
That is gutsy.
And at this time I had given up. I had told Columbia I wasn't coming, and I had been working, so I moved to New York City and I got hired by the Academy of American Poets.
Nice.
And so I worked there. That was my first job out of college.
Yeah.
And I worked there as the office gopher, basically.
Sure.
For the, you know, year and a half, before I got into grad school.
Oh.
And I called Bill Wadsworth after I had given up U of O. I called Bill Wadsworth, who was the director of the Academy, and I told him what I had done, and I asked if I could have my job back.
Yeah.
And he said, no. He said, no, you can't have your job back. You gave your job up. He's like, the only way I could hire you back is if I could hire you as an intern if you were at Columbia in the MFA program. And I said, I told them no, I gave that up. And he said, well, let me make a phone call. So he called up to Columbia, where he also had gone, and they said I could have my spot back.
Oh my God.
So I turned around, I moved back to New York City, I enrolled at Columbia, and I kept working at the Academy, and I was so happy with that decision. It was really the right thing to do.
Definitely. Wow, that is an amazing story. And who were some of the poets that you worked, not the teachers, but fellow students? Because I think you were, you know, it's amazing to look at like different like chunks of time through that program and to see. I know when I was there, I was looking back, you know, at like these different little generational pods of people that had gone through there. And it was really incredible. And I was just wondering, like, you know, who was there? Who were you sitting next to in workshop?
Yeah, I remember having one workshop with Claudia Rankine,
mm-hmm.
Christine Hume, Ben Downing, David Yezzi. There were at least those four, not Hightower, all people who've gone on to, you know, to have books and to publish. And so we were, we were together, and then a little later on, though I didn't fully overlap with them, they were just like a year behind me, there were people like Brenda Shaughnessy and Tracy Smith,
sure.
and Tim Donnelly and Mary Jo Bang. So there was another kind of, these were some of the poets of my generation who were around Columbia at that time.
And it was really
exciting.
Yeah, definitely. And the kind of just the aesthetic styles that end up coming through there are pretty divergent. And I think that says a lot about the program. Was it ultimately a really good experience for you? Was it challenging in any way? Did it push buttons for you in any way? Or did you really, were you like locked in and loving it?
It was challenging, but I really did love it. At the first year, I think I had a pretty typical experience, to a lot of students in graduate writing programs where I was just kind of clueless and wasn't writing all that well and, you know, was going through the paces. And it wasn't until the very last, workshop session in my first year that I wrote a poem that I thought kind of, signaled a change. And sure. That was the kind of work I wanted to write. And that was a workshop. J.D. McClatchy was the teacher, and mm-hmm. he did this thing where he sort of tapped the paper with his finger. I remember it. And he said that this is, this is the real thing.
Right yeah.
Here. You just crossed over and you've written something, something worthwhile. And I remember that really, really distinctly.
Yeah, that is. I was going to ask you kind of like one of those moments I think like a lot of poets have where they're like, that little one little moment of like great confidence building where somebody either gives you a yes or maybe it's somebody publishes a poem finally. But that moment when he kind of tapped the paper, I'm like, yes, Mark, you're heading in the right direction with this.
And
I know you've been interviewed about your first book quite a bit. And I loved how you talked candidly about just your general ambition and that kind of like manic process of like trying to get your work constantly in circulation. And it was really like a real pleasure to hear somebody speak so candidly about like, at the end of the day, we long for certain types of fame or we long for certain recognition and stamps of approval, whether we like to be all tough and independent. We still, in many ways, a part of us wants to boast to ourselves. And it's funny that you talked about earlier in your childhood how showing off your skills might be a form of boasting. And now we live in a culture with social media where boasting is ubiquitous and reflexive. And when your first book came out, I'm trying to remember the year, but the internet was nothing like it was now. It's very interesting to think about. But, one of the things that is being said about The Earth of Veils is that it's such a distinct departure from the first two books. I think I read an interview where you were kind of discussing whether it was like male gayness or homosexuality in popular culture. And how I think once the markets or popular culture kind of latch on to concepts of sexuality, they end up framing it in very hackneyed, sterile ways. And in the interview, I thought you were so dead on. Like, until pop culture really, like, tackles sodomy and that, like, guys fucking each other, like, it's always going to be this kind of sanitized version in the market. And it reminds me of, like, constantly, like, for the last 5 years, the hyper stylized, perfected, like a lesbian sex scene you see in movies now. It's like an obligatory lesbian plot going on always.
Yeah.
And I was really surprised by your comments about like the push towards, whether it was like, I think what you were saying is we've kind of lost like in our culture, the idea of gayness as like a subversive kind of thing. And it's more about acceptance or something. And I wonder if you want to speak to that for a second.
Yeah, well, as long as popular culture, the one of the key words there is popular.
Right.
It means that it appeals to the point of popular culture is to have it appeal to the largest audience possible.
Right.
And like gay people are always going to be a minority. It's a static number. It doesn't grow.
Right.
It just remains the same. And so whenever you have depictions of homosexuality happening in popular culture, it's going to be geared and created both by and for heterosexual consumption.
Right.
And so, you can have gay people producing that work, but they are just as likely to be trying to make it palatable to the mainstream.
Yeah.
And I think that, I find myself really startled and surprised at I'm still bewildered by the great push for gay marriage,
right,
as opposed to even, wanting to expand the rights in domestic partnerships or even, I think, even more progressive, getting rid of marriage altogether. You know,
right.
Why is marriage this privileged institution? I mean, we
right.
understand why it is the cultural roots, but it's so inherently conservative an institution.
Right.
And that here you have this minority that has been on the kind of outskirts, on the margins for so long, trying so desperately to be included in it. And the analogy I always think of is it similar to lobbying for to be allowed into the country club?
Right.
I don't want to be part of the country club.
Right. The very premise of the country club might be disgusting. So, I mean, I guess the only argument is once a marginalized group is in there, they can start renovating it somehow. You know what I mean? Like changing it. But I hear in your voice that you're kind of like want to call bullshit on it in a way.
I think
you're suspicious of the impulse, at least, you know.
Well, one of the things that you know, people say that they want acknowledgement, they want their relationships to be acknowledged publicly.
Right.
And I just keep thinking, why? You know, why do you want the heterosexual public to acknowledge your relationship, to acknowledge
right.
that you are, you know, that you are worthy? I mean, it makes me feel a little sad for those relationships that you need to have it acknowledged in some sort of public way.
Right.
I don't, you know, I mean, I don't have that impulse.
Yeah.
But I suppose I should probably, you know, I'm beginning to feel the other thing that I think is probably going to happen is there's going to be groups of, you know, of gay and lesbian people who are not who are choosing not to be part of that. And it's going to be similar to the way single people, you know, single heterosexual people are viewed in a culture where marriage is this sort of privileged institution,
right.
where you're seen as being, you know, a kind of outsider, maybe even pitiable in some cases. and I think that's, you know, we had an opportunity, I think, to offer alternatives to this very conservative institution. And I think we kind of blew it.
Right.
I don't think gay people are going to change the institution of marriage.
Right.
I just don't think that's going to happen. I think that the institution of marriage is going to support, in our culture, is going to continue to support the state, and it's going to continue to support a consumer culture, and it's going to continue to support all of the things that it does. But, you know, it's not going to be, it isn't going to make anyone freer.
I hear it. No, that's fair. It seems like, yeah, I mean, the premise of this kind of movement is it has been established by someone else's narratives who you claim not to share their values. So I'm wondering if those feelings and those kind of ideas, did they manifest themselves or did they like express themselves in any way, say in your first two books? Or was that primarily like, and hyper individualistic kind of thing you brought to those books, and then speak of this perception that The Earth of Veils is a departure from those two.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that my first book, it feels kind of like ancient history to me.
Yeah.
That book was written in my 20s. You
sure.
know, and it represents, for me, it really represents a very specific period of time. The thing that was different, certainly in the first book, that book was written at the height of the AIDS crisis.
Right.
And that was one of the real things that changed my life when I moved to New York. You know,
yeah.
In one sense, I was raised to kind of think of myself as this, you know, as a prince temporarily on loan to planet Earth, you know, I mean, that was one thing. And then I moved to New York City and I moved into an apartment in the East Village and I saw, you know, men my age in wheelchairs and I saw the kind of crack had just come into the East Village. The Tompkins Square Park had just been closed. There had been riots. I was there when they drove a tank down 13th Street, you know, to sort of deal with the kind of crime and the takeover of a house by drug dealers that had happened there. There was a black market selling stolen goods on the street every
sure.
night. There was incredible homelessness. It was a blasted neighborhood, and that's where I found myself. And I had suddenly gone from, you know, this kid from a farm to just another homo living in the East Village who,
right.
in the Reagan era, was by a good deal of the dominant culture was seen as disposable.
Right.
And that was such a shock to me to find myself in that position. That was, you know, and it changed me. It changed me forever.
You know,
it's knowing people who died of that terrible disease. It was, you know, and living in that culture during that period of time really did, change me. And I think that a lot of that first book is thinking about that, reacting to it, looking at it, and in a way, you know, so many of those poems are addressed to this missing second person.
Sure.
I think at the center of that book is a sort of missing beloved, the other who is gone, who has departed. And that was really, I think, for me, a reaction to that particular time.
Yeah.
My second book is a kind of, it explores, in some ways, I think these three books have been kind of a trajectory. I think it goes, the second book is halfway between the first one and the new one. But I wanted to divorce myself from the kind of confident voice that happened in that first book. And when I started finally working on, voluntary servitude, I was sort of horrified by the way in which the speaker in my first book, was so confident and bold and seemed to know, things. And in my 30s, I think I realized that there's so much I didn't know.
Yeah.
It was, it ended up being really different. And I wanted to write poems that, weren't as, I wanted them to kind of subvert some of the structures and things that I had done in the first book as well.
Yeah.
I think the new book is different in that it's not about sex,
right.
in the way that the first two books were. The Earth of Veils is the book of my mid-40s.
Right. And I think I heard, and sorry to interrupt, but it was interesting because at first, I think, you know, I read where you said, like, really taking on kind of the frame, kind of channeling kind of the forms of religion and faith, despite being, whether an atheist or not, extremely locked into spirituality. But that I thought it was interesting that in a conversation I read that you talked about where gayness had once been subversive and is now trying to be appropriated by whether it's market forces towards a heterosexual consumer, to the idea that speaking in the voice of a certain spirituality or faith would be equally as subversive. And then really, I mean, compounded, I think, with the physical settings of your poems. I think that you say, like, when you get to your 40s, it's kind of like, you know, if we should frame our lives in decades rather than maybe events, you know, the 40s can be a tremendously, like, sobering, kind of liberating time of just kind of knowing oneself. The wrestling is maybe different. And yet this book seems just as volatile, and yet you're doing it through the framework, a religious framework. And I was wondering how did you reconcile maybe not sharing the beliefs, these religious beliefs, but finding a cadence or a voice in it? You know, can you talk about that?
Yeah. I started working on this book, around the same time that I moved to rural upstate New York. And, my former partner and I bought this very old house. And we started this process about 300 years old. It was built by a Dutch farmer in around 1715. And we began this process. It was a wreck, you know, when we bought it, and we began kind of slowly and renovating it and trying to bring it back to life. You know, we did a lot of that. Much of the work we did ourselves, and so I found myself kind of sifting through these various layers of history as we worked, you know, as we peeled back the different layers of the house to try and get it back to its original state in some ways. And I became very curious about the people who had lived here and, who had built the house and what their lives had been like. And so I began kind of researching the material culture of that, of this place and time period. And I came across a family Bible in a local history archive, a Bible that had been attached to the family. And in it, I found this document, which was called a heaven letter. And it, this one was printed in German, and it was a kind of like a house blessing. And it was full of various sort of admonitions or advice. And, and I was immediately drawn to it and interested in it. And I copied it down. And in doing that, as I looked at it and thought about it, I thought, oh, I should see if I could just adapt this into something contemporary. What would that sound like? Yeah. And it was just an experiment, something I thought that would be fun to do. And so I did that. And then I started looking for more of these documents, and I found them. Then when I was home at my parents' house in Wisconsin, I found this Bible, a little prayer book. It had been published in the 19th century, so in the around 1870, and it was also in German, and it struck me as this kind of compendium of anxieties, you know, of the kind of fears. Each of the poems were very, or the prayers were very specific, like a prayer to be said at a harvest, a prayer to be said at a sick bed, a prayer to be said, you know, before a journey by sea. And so I began again that process of adapting them and seeing if I could bring them into a kind of contemporary milieu and have them reflect things about my own life. I was struck with both of these things by the voice, by that kind of supplicant voice that is both sometimes, you know, equal parts praising, and complaining, and begging, you know. I mean, those are kind of the three, I think it is the three different registers for prayers.
It's really wild,
I think the important thing about this is the connection I think that I made was with this book at my parents' house. If this had belonged to some relative, you know, and this reflected in some way their belief, and in adapting it, I wanted it both to have certain notes, certain, I found myself bringing a kind of archaic diction into play. But I also wanted it to be contemporary. So I feel like it, I wanted it to kind of flip back and forth between the old and the new. But I felt like I was somehow connecting with this ancestral past.
Right.
And I think what I've been really aware of in recent years is that my connection to this place where I grew up, which is very vivid to me, very, you know, there's a kind of family mythology that goes back generations that I've been told ever since I can remember. And I no longer live there. I'm not going to live there.
Yeah.
There are no children in my family. My parents will live out their days there, but that's going to be the last generation.
Isn't that something? Yeah, it's really incredible. I think, sorry to interrupt, but I think one you're describing, I think, is just a wonderful, you almost sound like the sleuth aspect of the creative process that started with the reconstruction of your house and kind of organically figuring out, I don't know, it's interesting. I just think about where you are in your life right now, what I've heard so far and that you're, you know, in your early 40s. And that it's a time in one's life, I think, where in many ways, that interior work that you've been mining all along, like the labor of that interior work starts to pay off, and one starts to want to connect to a broader narrative, and that tends to drive one back into excavating generationally beyond yourself. And what an exciting process that is, and that you can recognize the family in your hometown that's the last of the generation, that you're connecting in this whole new way into who you are as a person, and how satisfying that must have felt, and organically right it felt to start that process.
Yeah, you know, I think that I didn't really, I remember beginning to write some of these poems, and I was very uncertain. I just didn't know if they were any good, if they were viable as poems. I didn't really know, but I liked the process. I liked this adaptive process very much, and I just wanted to keep doing it. And eventually it began to kind of coalesce, and it started to make sense to me as a book.
Yeah, that's interesting. Like, as you're working on it, and it was nice to hear that you're still, like, even after kind of being somewhat, you know, an established poet, that you're writing new poems and you still feel vulnerable about whether they're working or not, which is really kind of refreshing to hear. And then at some point that process started, the idea of a book in this mode started emerging. I was wondering if you could talk real quick. I've really tried to wrap my head around the title of this book. And the use of the word avails is so, at times I'm locked into what I think it's intended to mean in the title. And then other times I'm completely baffled. I was wondering if you could just kind of explain what it maybe means to you. And was it a title you came up with, or was it an editorial suggestion?
It was a title that I came up with. And I guess I don't really remember the moment I arrived at it. I had spent some time reading. I was interested in the, I was reading some of the early Anglo-Saxon literature, so, you know, the old English literature, and I became quite fascinated. I think I arrived at these because of these sort of house blessings and the heaven letter poems, that I became kind of curious about spells and what those were as a kind of literary form.
Right.
And I found this group of poems in the old Anglo-Saxon that were that are treated sometimes as a kind of curiosity, but are different spells. One is for it's a spell against an imp. There's
nice.
Another one that's a spell against a, you know, a tumor, a wen on a cow.
Awesome.
And then there's one that is a sort of a spell that is meant to prevent bees from swarming. And I'm a beekeeper. I have bees, and so I was drawn to this one. And the poem, or this it's called the Anglo-Saxon Bee Charm, is usually how it's referred to. It calls the bees warrior women, and it says, you know, it says to prevent your bees from swarming and leaving the hive, pick up a handful of the earth and toss it over the bees and say this following charm.
Wow.
And they'll return to the hive. And it says, you know, warrior women, don't fly into the woods, be mindful of my needs too. And then you throw the handful of dirt, and it says, the earth avails against all creatures and against injury and against forgetfulness and against the mighty tongue of man. And that last part, I was so struck by this notion of the earth. The earth is going to outlast us. It's going to, it conquers everything.
Right.
Everything that, happens in this world is of the earth.
Yes.
And we can have designs and things that we want to do, but the earth is going to outlast us all. I think the other thing that is often on my mind is the terrible state of environmental degradation that we have found ourselves in, and it's in the way in which it's causing climate change. Climate change to me is just it's so difficult to wrap your mind around, because we experience everything locally and daily, and
I think that's so true.
And yet we have the ability to understand the scale of this problem, and everyone in the world has now experienced the kind of volatile weather and the storms and the shifting weather patterns, and this is just on the one hand, it's the Earth is going to win out. You know, we're going to wreck it for ourselves, and we're going to take a lot of species down with us. But the Earth is going to just be fine. It's just it's going to change. We're the ones who are going to be wrecked.
Right.
You know,
and it's so sad because it's a reflection of the worst angels of our nature, you know, and not the better ones, which are that we have knowledge of it. And I think it's interesting too. I think you're exactly right that it doesn't have like a visible, noticeable daily impact on our lives. And in many ways, we've defanged nature to the point that we don't even have to look at it anymore. And it's almost kind of an idea about the sublime, in that it doesn't cause us any pain, and therefore we discard it or resent it because we're so insulated from the impact of our own, the consequences of our own actions upon it, that you're right. It's like we need to, and even with these kind of strange, you know, weather systems that we've been enduring, a lot people, it reminds me of almost that the disenchantment of, say, believing. It's funny because I'm just making this parallel in real time, that you're drawn to these poems of spells and kind of enchantment. And in many ways, people can't believe in that anymore because they've kind of buffered themselves from seeing themselves as a part of this enchanted narrative that used to be spirituality or God or fairies or, you know, spirits or angels or whatever it was. We are like, whoa, we're totally not part of that. And in many ways, that disenchantment has now carried over in some weird way to the ecology around us, that it's as not real as God is to us or something. It's really fascinating. And in many ways, I'm just having this thought because you inspired it, is that your book is kind of taking both these ideas of this kind of remote God and this remote ecology, and what your poems are doing in The Earth Avails is forcing those two to come to a head. And it's really, I think that's what in many ways is so powerful about this book, is that you're forcing us to consider things we don't believe in anymore, and finding such a genuine voice in that. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think that's so where a lot of the power of your poems in this book are coming from, that you've taken two things we've lost faith in and have combined them into a singular speaker. Mark, do you have anything to say about that?
that hasn't occurred to me. I guess
it hasn't occurred to me either.
I think in this case I'm the bug and not the entomologist. So it's funny, you know, you write the book and then as you have to talk about it more, and you know, I've been going around and reading from it quite a bit, I'm starting to figure things out about the book, and I've gotten a couple of reviews so far that have actually that I was very pleased with, and they helped me kind of articulate and think about what this book is.
Go ahead.
You know, part of putting together a book of poems is that you're both. I think one has to try. It has to be kind of naive, about it at some point too, so that you can allow accidents to happen. Yeah. I was compelled to write these poems because I was compelled to write these poems, not because I had a larger design in mind of what it was I was interested in, but I do understand my obsessions, how I was looking at the world, the way in which I was, you know, engaged with life in the country again, the way I was thinking about my very rural upbringing in the Midwest, the way in which I'm kind of viewing mortality in my middle mm-hmm. years, and the sort of sense of the kind of fraying connection with the family history. And all of those things seem to me to be kind of coming together.
It takes a lot of, I think, for any artist or poet, because I think you're right. We're, you know, the poet is the bug, not the entomologist. And that it takes like a lot of, I think, a lot of confidence to just trust where you need to be taken with your poetry. And then, yeah, it comes naturally in retrospect once the book's out there, the poems are out there, that people are the entomologist. They're going to kind of see all kinds of things in your work. Do you think that's okay? That, like, I mean, not okay, but like, it is interesting how you said, like, now that the book's been published and you're kind of like hearing different thoughts about it, that it sort of illuminates things that in the act of composition, you're of course not considering, you know? And I think that's, it's a lot of dynamism there and probably gets into some very complicated and intentional theories or whatever, but enough of being the entomologist. Let's dive into some of these poems and hear some of them. Do you have your book right there?
Yes, I do.
So I wanted you to read a few poems that I've been dying to hear you read, and they're probably odd little choices maybe, but this little poem, Sand Shark, I was always taken with. One, because sharks don't typically occur on farms, and I was taken with the shark's response to what was happening to it. I was wondering if you could read it, and if you have anything to say about it.
Sure. The one thing that I would say, this poem is a bit of a throwback to the time when I lived on Cape Cod, mm-hmm. and it's, you know, about an experience that I had there. So I'll read it. Okay. Sand Shark. It rose up, nosing from the bottom of the bay, hook in its mouth, slothful, circling in a whirl through murk, salt, krill. It pulled at the line, but did not fight, no fit as I turned the reel. Long as my arm, it countered clockwise as I drew it, slick thought up from the dark reach of green and mollusk bed, up from where it fed on what dropped down, what fell to the wavering floor. In my shock, I wondered whether to cut the line or to pry hook and lure from its throat, from between the needled snags of its mouth, designed to hold all that entered and ferry it to the red chambers of its gut. I cut the line, nudged the sluggish creature with my foot, and slipped it back into the bay, its appetite torn by the barb of my hook. My hands were slicked with blood and slime, and though I washed, its briny tang clung to me for a time.
All right, thanks. That is so amazing, especially the end. My hands were slicked with blood and slime, like, and that briny tang. Oh, my God. So, you know, your work is so... you know, your eye is something to definitely endure, and it's interesting your fidelity to the image, and you seem to understand that description yields, you know, so much. It does so much work without you even knowing it, and throughout this book, your fidelity to the grim imagery is just so utterly compelling, because it gets through the illusions of so much of our lives, especially, you know, in modernity and especially when it's encountered in nature like this. But the sand shark, I thought it was interesting because I'm going to have you read Ram in a moment. And in Ram, we see a creature who is defiant towards the human, where this Sand Shark seemed apathetic and at repose in what was happening to it. And I thought, in many ways, your book is teaching us different ways we respond to pain and suffering in many ways. So if you don't mind, I'd love to see that contrast in the wonderful poem. It's one of my favorites, Ram, if you don't mind reading it.
Sure. Ram. He stands stamping in the pasture, angry that I've come, angry that I didn't come sooner with my pail of grain. A top notch of wool shields his eyes, snagged with bits of hay, bunched with burrs. He shakes his head, flares nostrils under a Roman nose, curls a lip to show me his single row of teeth like keys of a harpsichord, long, ivory yellow, pegged in a black gum. In snow, he'll stand all day by the hay feeder, fleece parting at the spine, grease saving him from the worst of it, staring into the source of the weather. In April, the shearing team will come and tip him on his rump, ridding him of a year's worth of wool. He'll submit to the indignity, his fleece peeled back in flocculent rolls. Back on all fours, he'll trot off to find his flock, sniff his harem's bare behinds, account for his many lambs that nurse desperately, confused by their mother's altered forms. They call and call while he remains calm, stepping among his kind, assessing the newly naked. Once he knocked me down with a blow to my hip, 300 pounds, and a thick skull crashed against my pelvis. Sprawled in the mud and dung, I pulled myself through straw while he backed up for another run. Before he could, I hit him with a broken rail, cracked it across his nose. He barely noticed. Now he regards me with golden ovine eyes, rich with a pastoral flame.
Oh, thanks. That was excellent. It's such a ruthless, ruthless poem. And especially that he barely noticed, man. When I remember first reading that, it was just so devastating. And, you know, the poems, it's interesting the way I think just kind of nurturing, violent kind of suggestions of the sexual act kind of permeate throughout this collection. And it got me thinking, you know, because so many poets, younger poets, are extremely enamored with the impact of technology and social media and putting hashtags before their poem titles, which is all great and fine. And I think I think they, if they're moved to do so, they have to. Were you ever worried that, like, you hear you come out with this very, you know, this book rich in I don't know if you want to call it pastoral imagery, but the rural countryside. You know, and clearly you know this world. What was it? You know, what did it seems that it was just kind of stripped of illusion. And I was wondering, you know, it just seems like a juxtaposition. I don't even know where I'm going with this, but it seems like a juxtaposition between that maybe the urban setting is very enamored with subjectivity and the self, where I think when the self is in this kind of environment where there's a constant exchange with the physical world, that the idea of the self is somewhat not as provocative because the violence of the physical world reflects and physicalizes the abstraction of the self. And so there's a clarity to your work that is absolutely, I think, seems subversive to today's voice. And it's because there's a real engagement with the environment. There's the proximity between you, the abstract self, and the physical. Is the proximity is almost non-existent. They're right shoulder to shoulder. And I think your poems are so keen on that. I don't know if you have anything to say about that. It's just really an observation.
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, I guess I keep going back to the, As a poet, I guess I'm now mostly interested in describing the world. You know, I think that my interior life is I suppose sufficiently interesting, but I don't, you know, I mean, in my first book, it seemed to be I was so kind of, my sexuality and my the sort of placement and realization of my sexuality in a social context was fascinating to me, and I thought I would make poems out of it. I'm not very interested in that anymore at all. That you know, my sexuality seems like so boring. And as one realizes that, you know, I mean, so I'm gay, big deal. It's not very interesting in and of itself. And but I now find myself wanting to write about the physical world and wanting to describe the natural world. I also, you know, I've always written, there are animals, certainly in all three of my books, I've written about them. They've been a part of my life, you know, growing up around them. And I'm, as fewer and fewer people have the experience, you know, in the U.S. of rural life and of farm life, I see this kind of, I'm always struck by the depth of people's misunderstanding and their sentimentality when it comes to the places, their conception of where food comes from.
Oh my gosh.
And the, and the kind of things that they think, you know, I sat in on a class, in which I heard a student report talking about how monstrous, you know, Monsanto is and how terrible it is that farmers make use of those products.
Right.
And I was listening to this and I thought, well, yes, Monsanto is this giant international monstrous corporation that produces poisons. But I'll tell you, you know, farmers plant Monsanto seeds because they work.
Yeah.
And, you know, there is a sense of that there's a way in which people are disconnected from many of the realities of it.
Right.
I also, you know, my interest in writing about animals has to do, most people's experience with animals are with companion animals of dogs and cats specifically. And those creatures evolved so differently than did other animals, in other domestic animals. And they live in our homes now, and we sentimentalize them almost exclusively.
Yes.
And I think that when I think about the other kinds of animals, you know, I mean, the thing that this poem is getting at, here's this ram. This ram is hostile, is dangerous.
Yeah.
A lot of domestic animals, they don't like you. You know,
right.
They don't love you. They're not interested in you. They're indifferent. Their absolute indifference to our existence, interests me. But I also, they are, domestic animals wouldn't exist without us, you know, and we as people who evolved, we wouldn't exist without them. Mm. So the relationship, I think, with domestic animals and a lot of wild animals is a complicated one, and I'm always interested in exploring that.
Yeah,
I'm interested enough in animals to try and see them in their complexity and not as sort of victims of our avaricious, and not victims of our appetites. Cows are the big evolutionary winner.
Yeah.
You know, if we want to talk about that, cows are, you know, cows won in terms of evolution. They proved themselves to be incredibly useful to human beings and therefore preserved their DNA for all of eternity. As long as there are people, there will be cows.
Love that you look at it that way. I think everyone has, and your comments about Monsanto and stuff, that we have, you know, these narratives that find their way among very smart people, and they're kind of based on a semantics of loss and blame and feelings of out of control. And I think you're kind of so interdirected to kind of just through your own experience to see it differently. And I love that your book does explore that relationship between these domestic animals and like your poem about the boar. And I was thinking about when I was reading this, because I mean, it's not wild at all what I did. I went to a farm outside of Philadelphia to get ice cream, and I just started walking around looking at goats, cows, pigs, whatever. And I thought about the initial reaction that I was having was, I instantly was aware of my similarities with that animal. I saw the cow's eyelashes, the skin strapped over the shoulders, the pupils of the goat, although different, you know, similar. And then the pigs started acting a certain way that I felt very suddenly, oh, I am different. And there was a constant exchange of familiarity and seeing myself in the animals while also seeing that indifference towards me in a way, that these animals kind of mock our vanity instantly in ways that are so profound. It's really amazing. I think the next poem I would love for you to read would be White Fur.
Sure.
And if there's anything you want to say about it before you read it, feel free to, or just go ahead and dig in.
I think it's pretty self-explanatory.
Yeah.
I'll just read it. White Fur. In the town of my childhood, little of note ever happened. So when the albino deer was found drowned in the slough, having been driven onto the punky ice by dogs, the game warden brought the dead beast to the school. I might have been 7 or maybe 6 years old. I suppose we were made to line up, since that is how we were moved from place to place, and were directed out the industrial doors to admire the animal sprawled in the back of a truck. We gathered around it, its whiteness a world bled of distinction, its eyes pink and drying in the prairie air. We were told we could touch it, and these many years since that March day, I can still see my hand, pink and small, buried into the white fur of the buck's neck, crackling with static and coming to life with the electric surge that animates all things. Later, the buck would be mounted and placed in a glass case in the bank, which is where the town kept things that were precious. Behind it, the art teacher rendered the bluffs and oils with the fussy hand of a miniaturist. And the buck remains there today in perpetual imitation of itself.
Oh man, that is so amazing. I just can't, the line where you're like, the game warden brought the dead beast to the school. It's like, hey kids, look what we found. You know,
I think that's the first impulse. Yes, but that's the impulse. But I have to say that this is so part of my experience growing up that, of course, that's what happens. And the teachers thought this was a great thing and took us all outside to go see it. You know, there was no...
It wasn't weird or anything. It was like, hey, look.
Not at all. I mean, this is how, you know, this is... Deer hunting, we used to get days off of school for deer hunting.
That's amazing.
I mean, it was such a big part of, you know, of the kind of rural calendar.
Yeah, it's really because it's almost like brought to the school, like this great mythical creature almost. And then that lining up, where's that line? It's so wonderful. Why can't I see it? I suppose we were made to line up, since that is how we were moved from place to place. And there's that idea of being kind of socialized in a way and that you're the type of child to reach out and touch this fur and the memory of that. And then the idea that there's this art teacher as a figure. I don't know. It's a beautifully rendered poem. It really is. And it brings to life the values of that area. Like the game warden and the guy in the truck, and they're, you know, not take it somewhere. Like, we got to show the kids this. It's just incredible. I love it.
And it's also, you know, I had this, I do have a fascination with taxidermy. And
oh, do you?
there was a lot of it. You know, there was a lot of it in my life growing up. And it's both, it has there's a quality of it that's kind of kitsch.
Yeah.
I love dioramas.
Yeah.
I love, those ways that attempt to try and render and recreate the natural world, this attempt to preserve it, and it always falls short. You know, it's the artificiality of it,
yeah,
that makes it more poignant. Even the most exquisite examples of it that you see at, you know, the Museum of Natural History in,
yeah,
New York or someplace like that. But there's you understand that you're looking at something artificial, that you're looking at artifice, and it seems to me this very kind of primal impulse,
yeah,
that we have to try and preserve this precious thing. Whereas,
right,
you know, the great beauty of this animal was when it was alive.
Yeah.
But you know,
there is a sense that it's honoring it at the same time, you know, that it's not like,
yeah,
it's not a gesture of conquering the animal to preserve it, but to honor it in some way, which reminds me, I was just at the National Zoo in DC, which was just a fascinating experience because many times, like, the animals just would turn their back on us.
Yeah.
And I would look at the crowd and I just thought, like, it's just so fascinating that humans gather to go, there's this defined demarcation, right, between us and the cage or the space they're living in. But the excitement just to watch a panda bear cross a grass plain doing nothing, you know, a completely mundane gesture by this animal. And it was breathtaking for some people. And 1,000 screens were lifted high above a fence, clicking pictures of it. And then other times, I remember a lion just would refuse to look at us, and, you know, and then I started thinking, like, oh, it makes me feel like I'm in a cage. I don't know. Just, I think you are definitely on the right track with this exchange between us and animals. I think it goes to the heart of, like, who we are in so many ways.
Well,
the last poem. Oh, go ahead.
You know, they define our humanness as well. You know, I think that. You know, you see a panda bear walking, and everyone just, you know, of course we go crazy for this.
Why?
Because I think that this is it goes as deep into our humanness as it can. You know, our you can imagine the very first, you know, human beings and seeing animals like this and wondering, is it dangerous? Is it,
yeah,
food? Is it, you know, is it a god? Is it,
yeah,
it comes and goes. We see it, then they disappear.
Right.
They're mysterious to us. Even, you know, even the cat that is sitting on my lap right now is,
yeah,
mysterious to me, in that I don't know what is possibly happening in that little head of hers.
Right.
But here she is, you know, she's attached to me and I to her. And it's a very, it's both mysterious and we understand it on certain levels, but it's also mysterious to us.
Right. There's a mutuality there and like complete mystery. It's like the philosopher Nagel's like essay back in, I don't know, I forget when he wrote it, you know, like, what does it feel like to be a bat? You know, like, you'll never know what it feels like to be a bat. And yeah, the idea of, oh, I mean, it does. It's like the animals bring out a kaleidoscope of feelings in us. And I imagine maybe the panda bear walking is, I don't know, I might have been just feeling envy that I couldn't just be doing the same thing. So the last poem of the book is Prayer in a Time of Sickness. And I read this like so many times, it really knocked me off my feet. So I'd love to have you read it to send us on our way out of here.
Sure. The one thing I would say about it is that it starts, here in the United States, and the poem ends in Iceland.
I was wondering. I don't know if I asked you that already. I was like, or when I was actually like working on a piece about this book, and I was like, this is Iceland, or is it Finland? Or I didn't know. So I'm glad you.
It ends in Iceland, so that's.
And real quick, before you start, there is, to describe for the listener, there's 1, 2, 3 movements to it. And the first movement, you said, distinctly takes place here. And then even at summer's end, I traveled north. That explains itself. Okay. So whenever you're ready.
Sure. Prayer in a time of sickness. So far, I have warded off the worst of things that can happen to a brain and to a body. I have loved myself and the world more than I have loved you, with your unknowable face in the firmament and the world ripe with detail. What is it you wish to teach me? My life has been one of tasks listed and attended, materials curried and weeded and laid by. I have been diligent and have done my work. Then a day came when I could not answer the letter of a friend, could not offer my help, read to the end of the sentence. The phoebe tossed from his nest was broken on vulpine teeth, spirited into the undergrowth in the dark. Then the 6 fat wrens in their house hung in the arbor disappeared, and their parents stopped their singing. Weeds grew, and I ignored my chores, while the cat worried her tail of its most plumescent fur. I saw my body white as tallow, my face framed by colorless hair, noted my appetites, then put them aside, walked and walked to wear it all away. In the bin, last year's potatoes grew their eyes without benefit of soil or sun, and I spent another night awake and unrested, knitting a cap for a child come too early into the world. What lies on the other side? What do I need to know that will keep me anchored, admired as I am from a distance, an image false as a tin star? I yearned to be cast up on an Arctic island, bare of trees, populated by the recalcitrant and their flocculent half-wild beasts, the air dry and howling, cliffs exposed, the wind stirring its cauldron of birds. You have written each of my days into your illumined book, though I believe this portion will remain unread, a page torn out and stuffed into a crack to keep out the winter damp. I was built by the love of my mother, then let go. She is now old and sleeps much of the day like a cat, eats small meals in her chair, bakes for funerals, or dusts a small museum visited only by accident. And so she serves the ghosts of our town and does not believe in you at all. At summer's end, I traveled north, crossed the sea to the salted rim of the Arctic. From a rented room, I watched revelers wend in arcs bound by the corrugated street, breakfasted on liver paste and beets, rode tinted in the light of a city bus as it ferried me to the national attractions, a heroic past reconstructed in wax, diorama of a seeress wearing catskin gloves, dining on the hearts of dogs, spidery manuscripts chilled under glass, and the rusted nails and altarpieces standing in for an architecture long effaced by the wind's hand. A young man named for a god of fucking rode his palomino next to my dun. His face was chapped, and his hair was combed by the wind from underneath a helmet of foam. We passed the named steadings, roofed in turf, the pyramids of hay, while our horses muscled like athletes on paths cut through knee-high grass, over lava and hill crest, past geyser and sulfurous marsh, horned sheep wandering wild through wind and rain. Hours went by and no one spoke as our animals huffed and pushed against the reins. My thighs tightened on my gelding's furred back, hands learned his mouth like that of a husband. Your hold on this island is tenuous, broken as it is by the core of the earth, seeping its sulfurous reek and sanding the air with ash. The inhabitants live amongst the greatest powers, visible to their water and ice-colored eyes. You are maddening abstraction. You, the triangulator, the great confuser, take note. For centuries, this populace huddled in the earth-walled halls, smeared black butter on dried fish, spun wool in the dark, washed their hair in urine, and fermented their meat in whey. How could you ever conquer a land that didn't know bread? You have left me here to wander, far from friends, my family shuffling about their small farm, your absent gaze pressing them toward the grave, the night numbing me to the evident good I might do or understand or receive. There is a bruise on my brain that does not heal, nor does it spread, walled in as it is by pills. Your name is nowhere to be found in my future, treeless and tasting of salt. Here I stand at the estuary, my horse cropping grass, no sounds of men save the one next to me as he pares dried mutton with a knife. Geese conduct their exercises nearby. The tide's green hair recedes, pulled backward by the blue-skinned moon. The wind lifts, sun flickers, guillemots trim the horizon with their wings. As your great thumb pushes against my lips and you click the snaffle past my teeth.
Mark Wunderlich, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.